redicecreations.com, and whether you're listening through our archives on the site, Stitcher, or iTunes. Thank you for tuning in today. We have a number of places and ways that you can listen, and we've made it as accessible as possible so that you can tune in to intriguing, educational, and controversial radio whenever it pleases you. We also spare you from commercial breaks, by the way. We know that you value your time, and so do we, as we want to spend as much time as we can with our guests. I hope that all our listeners that have been affected by Sandy over on the American side and Caribbean are safe and have managed to get back on track somewhat anyway, get power and internet back. Today we're talking with Troy McLaughlin, a British national brought up in New Zealand. He earned a bachelor's degree in Asian and American politics before embarking on an advertising and television film industry career in both New Zealand and later in Hong Kong, where he was a resident for 15 years. Fascinated by the cosmology of the electric universe hypothesis and its ability to provide rational and natural explanations for the mythological record, Troy recognized that a discussion on the model's implication and their effects on the practices of prevailing occult belief systems was largely missing within electric universe literature. Recognizing that the god Saturn plays an important role in some of the world's most deviant esoteric traditions, he wrote the website and Kindle ebook, The Saturn Death Cult, as an attempt to forge a link between the implications of Saturn theory and its detrimental effect on the beliefs and certain Saturnian-based occult groups and agendas. The Saturn Death Cult is an investigation into ancient planetary upheavals that heralded the birth and destruction of a fabled golden age. It attempts to trace how, following the demise of this golden age, mankind then degenerated into the obsessive pursuit of wealth and power through the perverted horrors of slavery, child sacrifice, and mass murder rituals. So today we're going to continue our conversation that we first started with Troy in January earlier this year. We'll focus on the Illuminated Ones, including their use of symbolism and the alchemical motives behind it. We'll discuss world government, wealth measures, and collectivism. Welcome back, Troy. Nice to talk to you again. Thank you for coming back on the program. It's nice to hear your voice again. How are you?
I'm very well, Henrik, and thank you very much for having me back on. I had a fantastic response to our last interviews that we did, and I've got to say that probably a reflection on the audience that you have, there has not been one antagonistic element to the contacts I've had at all. It's just been a very positive experience, so I'm really looking forward to more of the same.
Very good. That's good to hear. And, of course, you've moved headquarters a little bit over to England right now. We talked with you from New Zealand. Or were you in Australia last time? Anyway, England is. How are you finding it? Is it everything all right over there for you?
Oh, yes, yes. No, I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I've been a bit of a globetrotter, you know, my adult life. I lived in Hong Kong for nearly 20 years before going back to New Zealand where family commitments had taken me. And now we've basically moved the family what amounts to coming home because we're all basically British by origin, despite the funny accent that I have. And it's just fantastic. It's been very much a homecoming. We miss aspects about New Zealand, obviously, you know, getting back into British society and just simply some of the for my own personal interests, the wealth of resources there at my literal fingertips here. It's been a great experience. We're still settling in, but it's so far I can't say there's anything negative about it at all.
All right, really good. What should we call it? You're stuck in the European Union now. No repercussions of that. It's more difficult to feel, I guess, immediately. And Britain is doing, well, I guess, fairly okay, all things considering. I mean, there is definitely nations far worse in the Eurozone right now. But, yeah, we'll see how it goes, huh? We did four excellent hours with you last time you were with us, and this is ultimately where we want to send people to get up to speed. But I think, as always, Troy, it would be a good idea to kind of summarize as much as possible, the best you can in your ability, and quickly just run through some of the basic ideas and the basic concepts of the Saturn Death Cult, so we just bring potential newcomers up to speed here, if you will, Troy.
Sure. Well, as you sort of pointed out, 4 hours, we really only scratched the surface in many respects of what is an enormous topic. It really amounts, the Saturn Death Cult is a project that I started through a website and ultimately an ebook that seeks to basically tie in historical events with a completely new and radical cosmology that places a very prominent role for the planet Saturn as Earth's original sun. So basically we discuss the view that mythology tells us there once was a large stationary-like object situated at Earth's celestial north pole, and that this object was a sub-round dwarf star that later became the planet Saturn after a series of catastrophic celestial events. And we went on to discuss the concept that Earth had originally been a satellite of the sub-round dwarf star, and that the capture of this star and its satellites by our current host star, what we call the Sun today, initiated the series of catastrophic cosmological events, and the most profound of which has entered into the human psyche as an event called Doomsday. And this event, we discussed, saw the demise of Saturn itself as Earth's original sun, and the ending of a so-called Golden Age. This is a period of time that most mythologies talk about, a time of plenty, a time of perfection. And it was a time which we discussed in which Saturn, the actual planet, ruled from its northern celestial realm. We then discussed how the main archetypes of world mythology, that's the irreducible ideas and concepts that world mythology gives us, the hero, the father, the bride, and so on, the king, all these types of archetypes that come down to us, these are directly derived from these celestial events, and that subsequently mythology is actually a record of the human witnessed events, of these human witnessed events, and not the fictional imaginations of primitive societies. And from there, we can see that these very same archetypes form the base psychological condition for virtually all humanity, though we have now lost the origins of these archetypes in our modern and, I believe, erroneous interpretation of ancient mythology. And within all this, I propose that people simply dismiss the notion that the present is the key to the past and reconsider history in the light of the idea that the skies above us have not always been as they are, and that, in fact, they were radically and frighteningly different within the memory of humankind. And really from there, we looked at the consequences for the human experience these events had, and discussed the idea that the lost Golden Age actually represented a time when humanity first embraced the concept of the rule of law. This being a direct consequence of the planet Saturn's nova-like metamorphosis, having provided humans with the ability to calculate time, and from this all other weights and measures which then form the basis of law in the dealings of human beings were derived. And this, as we discussed, is why Saturn, or Kronos by its Greek name, is called the god of time. And we deduce from this that there had been a steady degrading of the human condition since then, based on the desire of various individuals and organizations to return to this perceived time of plenty called the Lost Golden Age. And basically that this initiated a conspiracy down through time to monopolize and control the productive output of most of humanity for the sole benefit of this privileged yet unproductive minority, which today often many of us identify as the financial elite. And due largely because the solar system had stabilized in its current form, the origins, the actual natural origins of the of mythologies had largely been lost, allowing this to happen. And we concluded with the idea that the main mechanism for achieving the state of affairs has been through the introduction at various times through history of a privately controlled debt-based financial system that ensures the eventual subjugation and foreclosure of all property and productive output of whatever society is placed under such a system. And this, again, is for the benefit of the elite minority. We just, and part of this, of course, is the role played by the manipulation of mythical archetypes and symbols as a way of authenticating the authority of this debt-based financial and monetary system and the con job that that is. And in that, we brought things basically full circle, I believe, in hopefully showing that these mythological archetypes are nothing more than artifacts of the overall corporate human subconscious that are deeply rooted in past cosmological and natural events. And therefore, aware people who become aware of this, should never allow these archetypes to be fraudulently misused by a financial elite in the pursuit of power and control over basically what is our inheritance, the resources and life-sustaining gifts of the planet we all live on. And I think that brings us basically up to where we had gotten to, Henrik.
All right, thank you for that. That's simple enough. A quick rundown there for everyone, but again, then just check out those 4 hours, because there's much more in terms of this to check out. But I think we should just kind of head straight into it, and again, to the best of our ability, kind of pick up here where we left off. And I think it would be good to dive into something you suggested here as well to me, and basically discuss who the illuminated ones are, the shining ones, and we can talk more about their modalities, their fingerprints, and there's much more to this. But give us an outline about this, who the illuminated ones are.
Okay, well, for those who don't know Saturn Death Cult or haven't read it, I use a stylized nomenclature, naming of organizations, events, people, and so on through them. One of the names that I use is the Illuminated Ones. They turn up throughout the text as shadowy figures, paradoxically. It's almost like an oxymoron. The Illuminated Ones tend to work within the shadows, behind the scenes, as agents of change, for affecting basically this attempt through history to monopolize the productive output of the larger majority of humanity. And it's one of those, because the world is largely obsessed with the idea of personalities and events being the cause of history, they largely overlook processes and ideas. And the Illuminated Ones are people who go a step further than just simply using the mechanics of a debt-based money system and so on, and they delve deeper into the understanding of what drives humans, and they basically have an innate understanding of the archetypes that can be triggered within all of us. Whether we all like it or not, we are all affected by symbols that trigger these archetypes deep within our subconscious. And the only defense against being manipulated in this way, of course, is knowledge of what these archetypes really come from, where they are. But in terms of these Illuminated Ones, they've learned through either private or organizational motives to manipulate the rest of us by the use of these particular archetypes and symbols. And, of course, we have a lot of people who will, long-term listeners, people who are within the alternative research movement, who will think I'm talking of people like Adam Weishaupt, the founder of the Illuminati, and so on. These guys certainly do play an important role, but I think there's a greater need to understand what I term a culture of belief, rather than a how would we put it, a conspiracy of belief, rather than a single-minded conspiracy coming down through the age. What Saturn Death Cult postulates is that there has been a culture of belief that allows conspiracy to thrive in various forms, and that these Illuminated Ones are the change agents most behind many of the developments that we see in the processes and the ideas that affect humanity, as opposed to being personalities and events.
How much do you think that they leave their fingerprint, if you talk about the symbolism for a little bit? There's a lot of corporate logos out there that harkens back to Saturn in one way or another, and this could be through color, it could be through shapes, or it could be through the rings, if you will, as well.
Yes.
What do you think about this? And maybe we can kind of break this down a little bit and how you see this from your point of view, and if this is any kind of signal or communication, if you will.
Well, I think it's directly relevant. The symbolism is actually their fingerprints. It is most definitely the mark of what I call the illuminated ones coming into the open. And, of course, probably the granddaddy of all symbolism in terms of Saturnian archetypes would be the all-seeing eye being stamped on the U.S. dollar bill, which is the current reserve currency of the world. And, of course, you know, anybody who's done any research into that knows that a guy called Henry Wallace, who was a secretary in some capacity to the U.S. government in the 1930s, was particularly influential in placing that particular symbol on the U.S. dollar bill. And, of course, we know Henry Wallace was very much involved in dabbling in the occult sort of movements. He was a theosophist and was extremely influenced by a Russian mystic called Nicholas Roach. Basically, these influences of his were steeped in the symbology that has come out of ancient mythology and which can be traced directly back to the cult of Saturn. As the basically father god of all religions, all deistic beliefs, and so on. So yes, the corporate world is infused with these symbols. And the people who have maintained a link with these symbols that relate to these archetypes in mythology have done a fantastic job in ensuring that they remain in the forefront of our collective consciousness. And basically they serve to trigger the required responses that these illuminated ones would want to have. And, of course, that brings us to, you know, the main philosophical, what would you call it, motive behind why these symbols are used.
Maybe we should head into that right away then. I wanted to ask you later about what some of the other proponents or parts of this is, rather. The color black, as I mentioned, is kind of prominent, associated with Saturn, as we mentioned last time.
Very much
cubes,
so. Yeah.
Hexagonal patterns, and again in the logos we see these kind of parts of rings. If people just imagine the Nike logo, for instance, it's been theorized that is basically just zoomed in on a section of the rings of Saturn from kind of a little bit of an angle. So is that all part of it? Is that all these things part of the methodology and the science, if you will, of the Saturnalian brotherhood?
Yeah, I actually prefer, Henrik, to call it an alchemy of symbolism. Down through the ages, certain symbols are so imbued in our subconscious. In other words, they trigger things within our subconscious that you can't help but have a reaction when you see them, even though you're not really aware, especially in this modern age. It is a fact that certain symbols, and really people who work in advertising are acutely aware of this when it comes to branding goods and so on. There are certain colors, certain geometric shapes, and so on, that have a visceral effect on people, whether we like it, and that's happening at a subconscious level. And the illuminated ones down through the centuries have simply been people who have been aware of this. So while I talk about the debt-based money system as the mechanism for control and creating a state of subservience to a basic broad conspiracy of captivating the whole productive capacity of humanity, what I see is that there are a group of people who go beyond just simply the profit motive, and that these people have delved into these symbols. Now, I put a caveat on it and say they're not all sitting there going, hey, whatever this bloke Troy McLaughlin has written about and so on, he's finally starting to get to the truth of what we know. I don't believe they themselves really know the origins of these things. They are just people who have an innate understanding as to their effect. And so they use them, and they get a kick out of it. And this is their particular motive down through the ages, you know, in which they seek to influence various parts of society to build up the elite and to propagate the continuing debt-based money system.
So someone basically could unwittingly have been aligning themselves to this philosophy without really knowing it.
Yeah, and it comes back to what I'm trying to get across to a lot of people is that we come back to the idea that the Saturn Death Cult is talking about a culture of belief. And I've thought about how to try and give an analogy to this. And what I would do is I would point at Christianity in the modern era. And I would say that if you were somebody living in the South Pacific before the advent of Christianity reached them, you would be faced with the idea that these missionaries want you to convert to Christianity. So we can call that the conspiracy to convert people to Christianity. And I think whether people see it as a good thing or a bad thing, that's what it is. There is a conspiracy to go around the world and convert the majority of humanity to the Christian concepts. But if you were somebody who was actually living in these areas and decided to study who are these guys coming along and talking about Christianity, they would, and they had, for instance, the access to resources like the internet that we have today, they would come back and they would say, this is very confusing. You basically have over 500 Protestant denominations, a giant thing called the Catholic Church, the Orthodox movement and so on, and they're all in on it. But, you know, they're all linked to each other, but there seems to be different agendas within the overall conspiracy to convert people to Christianity, and it would present itself as almost as a madhouse if you looked at Christianity from that point of view. You wouldn't know who was actually with who and who represented what. But for people like you and me, Henrik, who are brought up within a Christian environment, Christian culture, and have that as part of our overall understanding, this is not really a problem in understanding. Do you get where I'm going
sure.
with this?
Yeah.
It's, you know, we know the differences between a Lutheran and a Catholic church. We know the basic ideas behind Protestantism and how they affected the Renaissance and the Enlightenment and so on like that. But to an outsider, somebody who just starts moving in on this, it really is an absolute maze of who's who and who's doing what, and really what are the doctrinal conflicts and the theological conflicts, yet they all seem to have this one particular aim, and that is to convert the whole world. Now, that's my analogy of what the Saturn Death Cult is. And what the Saturn Death Cult is a culture that promotes this idea towards what effectively is world government or the collectivist ideal, whereby a small minority get to basically govern the vast majority of humans and basically monopolize the productive capacity of those humans for their own benefit. Now, what I brought up there is the idea of what is called collectivism as being analogous to the idea of, you know, this collectivism being essentially world government, the idea of it's analogous to the idea of Christianity and its desire to convert the whole world to their particular doctrinal beliefs. And what collectivism is it basically it emphasizes, this is taking a few notes from, anybody can look this up on Wikipedia for a definition, but it emphasizes the interdependence of every human being, and it stresses the priority of group goals over individual goals. And collective ownership of the means of production and collective decision-making or worker self-management within economic enterprises. Now, there's a particular virulent form of collectivism that we call corporatism. And this basically means that the whole is being greater, the whole as being greater than the sum of the individual parts, and that this gives priority to group rights over individual rights. Now, this plays directly into the psychology of this motive to capture the productive wealth
the whole of humanity. It's a wonderful idea that, hey, we're all in it together, and so therefore everybody's got to pull for everybody else. And by the way, we have the plan of how to do that. So look to us.
Yeah.
All right. And subsequently, how do they put their authority on there? How do they solidify their claim to authority? That's when they start delving back into these archetypes that trigger literal emotional and intellectual responses within us that says, hey, these guys seem to know what they're doing. They can point to things that give them authority and some kind of knowledge into the past. Now, as far as an overall philosophy goes in identifying the work of how these illuminated ones, as I call them, work, and bear in mind that I'm talking about the illuminated ones in the same way I was talking about the various types of Christianity that we
right.
see in Protestantism and so on.
Yeah.
Within this collectivist ideal, there is a single unifying idea, and it can be largely looked at in the modern era in the form of the philosophy of a certain guy called Hegel. And Hegel, being a German philosopher, had the foresight, some people would say, to basically come up with a concept of what he called the Hegelian dialectic. And essentially, this is the idea that you have a thesis, an idea, that is opposed by an antithesis, and then when the two come into conflict, it is reconciled as a synthesis, which is a form of consensus of those two ideas. So basically, Hegel said that history was nothing but the expression of this flux of conflicting and resolving ideas. And since basically this thesis of this new dialectic guarantees social change, the process continues until society reaches what Hegel called the absolute idea, which is the ultimate synthesis, which there can be no antithesis to. And, of course, in the context of this, the absolute idea is world government, i.e. there is nothing to oppose the consensus that we all reach to allow ourselves to be governed by one central thought process.
Yeah.
Make sense?
Well, a really good point, Hegelian dialectic. Think about it from the point of view of politics, the left and the right, and while people are aligning themselves with these ridiculous ideologies and fighting, we're steadily moving towards world government nonetheless, and it doesn't
matter which
side we align with, you know, so...
Yeah, and of course, what I argue in Seven Death Cults, it's not an original concept, is of course the idea that the monetary system as we have has been utilized to finance, these thesis and antithesis developments that come into conflict with each other in a way that manipulates the outcome. To push us towards these things, and this concept of the absolute idea that is world government. This is the underlying philosophical. It's sort of the culmination of the philosophical idea of what I would call these illuminate ones.
Yeah.
But you know, it goes so far back into time that Hegel is just simply the. Sort of the modern incarnation of this. And in fact, I actually don't rate Hegel as a as what you would call a an illuminated one per se. I just think he was simply a philosopher. It was a strange thing with Hegel. He obviously a very egotistical man because he basically had believed that by coming up with the overall concept of his dialectic resulting in the absolute idea, that he represented the pinnacle of human development, that he had actually become the example of of the realization down the ages of thesis versus antithesis and so on. And it was akin to watching a movie of yourself and reaching a point where suddenly you realize that you're looking at yourself looking into the camera. and you reach real time. And he believed that history had culminated in his insight into this idea. But nonetheless, it's a ready-to-made philosophy for the financial elite to, you know, once they understand the mechanics of it, great, we can start to manipulate outcomes as we see. And this has largely been how I believe the last 200 years of history have progressed in terms of the financial influences behind the scenes. They back one, they back another, they bring them into conflict to create the required change, and then they start the process again.
That's right. Yeah, very good point. Internationalism and Fabian socialism, and so let's talk about Soviet communism, and if that is a Saturnalian idea. And again, we can, you know, look at the symbolism itself of the hammer and the sickle, but there's so much more beyond that. Do you also believe that that is a part of the plan of bringing this ideology basically onto the world stage of bringing this international, Troy?
Yes, most definitely. These particular ideologies, you could call them, or movements, these are the thesis and antithesis of you know, of our time. People who get involved in them often see it, you know, as genuine in and of itself, whichever movement they're a part of. Take, you know, anybody who joins communism and so on like that, they can imbue themselves with the ideals. But at a greater, more macro level, we can see how this has created the ongoing conflict, you know, management of the world from behind the scenes. And of course, the ultimate form of control to keep conflict of the to keep such conflicts under control is to control whatever functions as the monetary system, the financial system. You know, so, you know, I'm convinced communism in its Marxist form followed that line. I would say the only A plus I ever got at university was writing a thesis on the idea that the Russian Revolution was actually brought in from without and was not an indigenous phenomenon for the Russian people. And, of course, I actually went into what people would class conspiracy theory, and my professor was definitely no conspiracy advocate, but I showed the financial backing for Trotsky coming in from the Warburg through Jacob Schiff and co. I showed the I managed to get reference to the newspaper clippings in Canada, the capture of the ship with all the gold, with all the Trotsky agents that went in. And I showed that the Warburgs, on the other hand, were also financing Lenin's trip to Russia by a you know, an enclosed train through German territory. How they pulled that off, how they negotiated such a trip, is one of the great mysteries. Unless, of course, you understand that Lenin and Trotsky are just simply agents for a far greater, you know, agenda.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an amazing story. There's so much to that, and the way that it was brought onto the world scene as a way to bring Russia down onto its knees, and therefore on a corporate capitalist and banking system, being kind of a monopoly in America. And you, and again, now what happened with that is that you created the thesis and the antithesis right there. And these were the forces that were fighting with each other for the next, you know, what, 60 years, maybe even more.
Yes, definitely. The you know, I mean, we also know that the same forces, particularly financial forces, were started to get stuck into financing the Nazis. We know that financial interests were very much behind the rise of fascism, that fascism really is just simply corporate control of the state through through government, and that's what had happened in Italy. But the Hitlerian version of it through the Nazis, particularly virulent form of fascism, was initially financed and can be shown to be financed by American concerns. American business concerns. There are families, the Bush family was involved in it, and suffered as a result of their connection in the aftermath of the war to a certain extent. But nonetheless, those contacts existed in terms of financing the rise of the Nazis. And, you know, the interlinking of the financial system And I've always argued this, that in the Saturn Death Cult overall idea, I want to show that there is this overriding supranational state called, I call them a kingdom of merchants and so on, but, you know, you could call a nation of merchants, mm-hmm. a nation of merchant bankers who are not dedicated to any particular country or any particular nation or any religion for that matter, but basically within their own set of laws and their own set of ideals. And I think this is largely, I think this is largely borne out by the fact that during the Second World War, one of the greatest cataclysms we are told to ever hit mankind, the banking establishments of the nations at war with each other continue to operate with each other.
Yeah.
That's an absurdity. But that's what happened.
So they use anything that they can to advance their own agenda. It doesn't matter if they have to side with the Nazis for a while, they will. If they want, have to side with the Soviet Russia, the Soviets for a while, they will do that. And there is a, I don't know if you read that, but the Empire of the City, a pretty good book that details this from an English point of view, where they basically show that at different times throughout history, the British Empire has aligned themselves with the force that was, I guess, the, well, no, let me put it this way and say they aligned themselves against the force that was the number one, if you will, in the world at the time. Mm-hmm. So they constantly try to keep a balance of no one should get ahead too much. We'll always try to kind of shoot down the one who's kind of advancing a little bit and taking off a little bit, so that London and the city of London specifically has seen themselves as a kind of a balancing force in the world, that we should not allow anybody to kind of get ahead, so we keep everybody on an equal level, which of course ultimately means that it's they who are going to control the game. Have you read that book, by the way, The Empire of the City?
I haven't, but the themes that you're expressing there definitely dovetail with a lot of what I've read about the City of London. For people who aren't aware, the City of London enjoys a quasi-autonomous status similar to the Vatican in Italy. Here in Britain, they have their own police force. The Queen, I believe, has to ask permission to enter there. They are a force in their own right, and certainly through the ages, the effect of the City of London policies in what you describe, this backing certain interests against other interests to destabilize, to then create a balance between two similar sized forces and so on. Without doubt, that is what has happened down through the ages, and all under the auspices of the of those who control the purse strings.
And even if you look at the book, it's an excellent chapter in the beginning there, where they show as little as 1 year, they show how England aligned themselves with Russia 1 year, and then against mm-hmm. Russia the other, and with France 1 year, and against France, you know, the other year, and so forth, with all the different nations out there. It's just amazing to look at this rundown chronology, if you will, of that timeline, and how any nation could kind of, I guess, go along with this. It's just amazing. But it alludes to the fact that there's more going on behind the scenes of those who are controlling those nation states. As a follow-on question to that, do you think, though, that there is a... Well, you've explained that in a sense, but let's talk more in detail about that. If there is an inner circle here as well that is in the know, and if they initiate newcomers into it and hence also can manage to keep it going over the centuries and the millennia, Troy?
There is an inner circle has been exposed in non-conspiracy workings. What's his name? Carol Quigley.
Sure.
Wrote openly about this idea that there is a sort of driving plan behind this. Again, I pull this all back to the collectivist ideal, that really what we're all working towards is the concept of world government, and all that's been worked out really behind the scenes is who gets to run the world government and who the main powers are to be. I'm very much convinced by the concept that was brought to the attention of the world by the journalist Daniel Estulin in looking at the Bilderberger Group. He refers to a term that they use amongst themselves called the aristocracy of purpose. which belies the sort of arrogance on the part of these people that their purpose in life is to basically decide how the outcome of world history progresses. And, you know, I think it's pretty much conclusive that groups like the Bilderbergers certainly are conduits for whatever inner circle is working there to you know, effect into reality the their programs and their policies for the world as a whole.
Would you say that ultimately they are bureaucrats? They're make the decisions with the pen rather than with the sword. Maybe they did that in the past, though, but these days, as you said before, they don't really, I guess, produce anything per se. They just tell others what to do from a political and a bureaucratic point of view, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And bureaucracy only functions when you have a viable financial system that pays bureaucrats to function. And, of course, a financial system that is based on taxing its people and so on like that is the beginnings of such a thing. But when the financial system is debt-based, it has a finite lifespan. And the bureaucratic thing really just becomes a tool for the effecting of policy. They gain a certain amount of power, but bureaucracies are themselves, I believe, a complete expression of collectivism. They are the means by which you enforce the collective ideal that the needs of the group outweigh the needs of the individual.
What would you say is the antithesis to that? Individuality, freedom, a free market
individuality.
System?
Yeah. Individuality and true free enterprise becomes that. If you go back in time, the opposite to that really starts, I believe, with an age-old concept of what is ownership. Celtic concepts and certain Amerindian concepts and certain Asiatic concepts always placed the concept of ownership in the custodial form rather than the sovereign form. And the custodial idea is that you have a right to own the property of whatever you produce, but you you owe a rent, so to speak, on where you take your resources from. Okay, mm-hmm. So under these sorts of terms, if you have custodial ownership of some land, you grow some trees, then part of what you harvest from the land has to be given back to the land somehow or back to society. But what you harvest that is then sold on to a second party, if they then make something out of those trees, furniture for instance, they are completely within their rights to claim ownership and sovereignty over what they produce with their own labors. Now that's a very old idea of what free enterprise really worked upon. Where that all changed was when you had ownership and perpetuity of the actual resources of the land, you know, as a head. I should say that what went hand in hand with the with this Celtic Amerindian sort of idea was, of course, the idea of forgiveness or the Jubilee concept that all debts were forgiven at some point, and it was you started with a clean slate. When they moved to ownership and sovereignty of ownership of the land, they created land speculation as a part of the economy, and land speculation is, you know, hand in hand with a debt-based system, simply because once you change the concept of ownership over land to one of ownership and perpetuity or freehold forever, you can then institute a system that allows you to, through foreclosure and debt, start to accumulate land under your control. And, of course, land being ultimately the source of our productive capacity, this gives you ultimately control over that source of productive capacity. And we're back to the collectivist one world ideal that it's better that this is all centrally controlled from one source.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, look what the Soviets did. They took every resource and all the land away from people who had, had it for centuries in some cases in families and in lines, and they've been producing and everything else. And again, I mean, Russia before the revolution was basically like the breadbasket of the world, and after that, everything fell to shambles, and nothing was produced after that point. It's really interesting.
Yeah, sure. Basically, the old joke, you know, Khrushchev, Russian politician, was a magician. He's the only guy who could sow seed in the Ukraine and harvest it in Kansas. it was an unbelievable indictment on the whole collectivist ideal that was experimented in with the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And we've seen the results of where that comes. But yes, to go back to your original sort of question, the opposite of this, of course, is the individual. And it is the individual's interests. Those who recognize that we can have a society where the individual is only governed by a concept called the law, i.e. his dealings with every individual he comes into, rather than the idea that two individuals have to include a third person called the state in determining how their agreements work, then we can see the differences between the two systems. I would go so far as to say that the only place where you see now a true free enterprise system is paradoxically and unfortunately manifest in the international illegal drugs industry. Those guys always settle out of court.
Yeah.
And, once upon a time, ordinary productive capacity of humans could be done in such a manner. And you'd only involve a third person when there was a dispute in the legal contract between you two.
Yeah. Okay, so very good point you're raising here. And also, capitalism has been harshly vilified definitely in the last few years due to the bankers, due to the economic situation. But this has been everything but a free market capitalist system. It's been heavily regulated and also in all the wrong areas, I think. It's been actually crony capitalism, not really, free market capitalism. It's been there to benefit the elite, the bankers, and the illuminated ones. And so do you see a danger in throwing out a true free market system, as seems to be actually what most people seem to advocate these days as a fix for the problems that we are in? I think that this would be detrimental even more so. We would end up deeper into the problem, and again, we would kind of move into this international Agenda 21 socialist/corporate state where basically you cannot have any freedom when it comes to what you purchase and what you produce and everything else. So I see it as a problem. What do you think about this, Troy?
Well, I think the, there's that saying, what was it, Rahm Emanuel, never let a good crisis go to waste. Essentially, they are looking ahead. They're seeing the opportunity in the chaos brought about by collectivist capitalism or financial capitalism as opposed to free enterprise capitalism. They're seeing that as an opportunity to say, well, that's just more proof that we've got to have an ironclad central control.
Yeah.
Over how we go about things to stop this happening ever again. And I've always put it that it boils down to two mutually exclusive concepts, a form of doublethink almost, on the part of people in understanding what law actually is. And when people understand that law tells you what you can't do, but the collective ideal really is pushing us towards the idea that the law tells you what you can do and only do.
Yeah.
All right. This is a fundamental difference, and people have to assess when they look at where they want to go with this crisis, which is an opportunity, possibly to break free of a lot of the problems that have been building up under finance-driven capitalism. But they have to assess, is the solution going to determine what I can do and only can do, or is the solution going to free me so that I know where my boundaries are, but wherever that is not demarked, I am completely free to pursue whatever desire I have.
Mm, yeah.
You know, this I think is the fundamental philosophical question that people look at. They get constantly sidetracked that the law should tell you what you can do to ensure that you don't do anything wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. And collectivism have also worked in the sense that it's for an altruistic system, meaning you're not supposed to fulfill your own dreams or your aspirations of what you want to do. It should be a constant sacrifice of yourself. And again, this has nothing to do with the fact that we should help each other, take care of each other, or whatever. That's not what we're talking about here. I'm talking about the idea that you can actually have an infrastructure where you actually can fulfill those dreams and aspirations that you have, you know, as a human being. Yeah. But if this is taken away, what we're left with is this system of sacrifice where we constantly have to give up our own individuality for the collective, for the greater good of everybody else. And it basically says, you know, no one is special in that way. And we're now in the ant form more so than in a human civilization, you know.
Yeah, so we get situations now where, you know, you've got the new president of France, Hollande, you know, declaring that he's going to ban homework because there are certain children that don't have parents to help them with homework, and the ones that do have an unfair advantage. You know, we have these sorts of ideals now coming down, which basically says, this is what you're allowed to achieve.
Yeah.
You know, this is the difference, all right? You know, the other idea says you can achieve anything you want as long as you don't cross these lines. Now, people could say, yeah, but, you know, when they build up enough lines, you're back to the same idea. You're in a box. And that's true. And, you know, it really comes down to, which is one of my sort of, you know, real hobby horse things, is getting it right as to what kind of laws we want to live under. And it all starts with having, I believe, an accurate weights and measures system, particularly in the financial system.
Yeah.
As such, because I honestly do believe that at the end of the day, the financial system takes away, we're so desperate to make that non-existent 1% interest to cover our debts that we end up basically taking everybody else for a ride if we can to get ahead. To make sure we're not that part of society that is guaranteed to fail.
Yeah. Yeah, again, it's based on sacrifice. Again, that we talked about last time, right? The mm-hmm. system is built as such that it's predatory, and therefore someone has to be sacrificed, and that someone has to be the loser all the time. And that's, again, that has nothing to do with a free, you know, open individual system to do with, basically. Again, it's like it's based on an old, ancient and superstitious idea, basically, that you need to have a victim in this case.
Yeah, and that's the literally the doctrine of unforgivable debt. If you give people, you know, the old con game that money is today, if you give a group of people $10 and say you've got it for a year but I want $11 back and there are only those $10 in all existence, then they come back. They're not going to have that 11th dollar because it simply doesn't physically exist. And you then have made some kind of contract with them where they've agreed somehow, and it comes back to, you know, use of symbolism and the archetypes to con them into this ridiculous idea. But they come back and agree that if they can't come up with their 11th dollar, that is the interest, then you can foreclose on them. Well, let's face it, the ultimate sort of horrific implication here is that you've got too many people, so we're going to have to get rid of the people to bring it back into balance who can pay the debt that way. You know, there is that sort of train of logic that follows through, and of course we see that in the eugenics movement, there's these Georgia Guidestones that give this idea that you know, there's going to be a group of people that determine how many kids we can have to keep it at a certain balance. And that's a debt, that's a sacrifice that we have to pay. And if we go over it, then we've got to sacrifice part of the population for the greater good of all, collectivism.
Yeah, the elite priestarchy of wise elders that know much better about what, you know, how you should live your own life than what than you do individually.
Absolutely, whereas I simply believe that the idea of contract between individuals based on, you know, that forms law is the one deciding factor in how we relate to each other. We don't need a third person saying, today you can say hello. No, tomorrow I'm going to send you to war against them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's, you know, the centralized idea of government is has proven itself to be an extremely dangerous proposition. And, you know, government largely, if you look at people who tried to reform it, the founders of the United States, what they call the founding fathers of the Constitution and so on, you know, basically had the idea that government was there for two purposes, to enforce the law between individuals and to act as an agent to form a defense should that group of individuals under the Constitution come under attack from without.
Yeah. I can't believe people don't see this. And again, but they're at this time walking right into the trap that has been set up for them. And they now, you know, demand basically things that they 10, 20 years ago would never have asked for. But now it seems like a, you know, a good outcome to a really rotten situation. So again, it's Hegelian dialectics. It's about creating the situation so bad enough and between these two options so that you're forced to merge into this third way, basically.
Very, yeah, and I clever. Think, you know, I've actually been asked by a lot of people, because I made comment on the current crisis that we're in. We certainly are living in historical times. And I think in my last interview with you, I said today's crisis is probably most mirrored by events in the 1340s that led to the Black Death and the famine there, and basically a huge reduction in population. But all the hallmarks of how the financial system collapsed before that, leading into the Black Death and so on, we're seeing the same sort of thing on a much larger scale taking place, you know, literally as we sit here. And it's fascinating on one count, it's horrifying on another.
All right, Troy, let's take a break here, and then we'll talk more in the second. We have much more to discuss, and it's very interesting and very, very important perspective, I think, we're talking about here. Now, let's talk about your ebook, first of all, and your website, what people can find there. And if there's anything else in the works for you, if you're kind of developing this and continuing the thesis, I guess.
Yes, there's a lot more at play. I'm looking very much into the physics of the Saturn polar configuration. I'm pursuing an extremely fascinating study into the idea that there had existed a Neolithic, if you could use those terms, the Neolithic period, a world war fought between Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon man. That ties in very much into my concepts of the Purple Dawn that I put in Saturn Death Cult, the concepts of the Purple Dawn creation. I'm also doing a lot of study into the financial crisis of 33 AD that struck the Roman Empire, literally as a precursor, not a precursor, but as a parallel in history to what we're going through at the moment. There's some startling stuff from that time that corresponds to what we're going through in the current financial crisis. But yeah, my website is SaturnDeathCult.com, and that has also been released in the form of an ebook under the same title, The Saturn Death Cult, which is available on Amazon. And you can, if you go to my website, you'll see it advertised in the top corner there. Basically, that would be where I'm at the moment.
Excellent. SaturnDeathCult.com. Go there, read more, and pick up a copy of the book when you want to read more about all this stuff. Of course, it's collected there in a very nice way. It's available as a Kindle, I believe, as well. So that's really good stuff. We'll take a short break here, Troy. We'll return with more in just a little bit, so stay with us. Thank you. right, well, stay tuned for more as we carry on in the second hour for our subscribers on redicemembers.com. Sign up for a membership to hear the continuation of this program. You also get access to all our previous programs and our archives. Of course, this includes videos, films, TV episodes, and our commentaries. When we proceed, Troy explains how the Saturnian Illuminated Ones use archetypes to propagate an agenda. He'll talk about the German composer Richard Wagner, who Nietzsche accused of being a change agent. He'll also talk about Stanley Kubrick's use of Saturnian symbolism. Later we cover UFOs, breakaway civilization, Nazis, and the agenda of the Saturn death cults. We have more radio for you coming your way soon. Next, George Cavazos, then Randy Powell, and Carol De La Haran, to name a few. We have our full guest list on RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com in the radio archives. Stay tuned for the second hour with Troy coming right up. Don't miss it.